The pre-K through 12 appropriations subcommittee will come to roll. Rosa, will you please call the roll?
Chair Fine.
Here.
Vice Chair Bell.
Here.
Representatives Lupus.
Here.
Andrade.
Here.
Bartleman.
Yes.
Bush.
Here.
Fetterhoff.
Here.
Hay.
Here.
McLean.
Here.
Roach.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Trunell.
Here.
Valdez.
Present.
Wilhite.
Here.
Williams.
Here.
The quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, thank you. Members, please make sure all electronic devices are turned off and on vibrate. And I'm going to apologize in advance. I have a lot to talk about today, and I'm going to keep my mask on, which means my glasses fog up, so I'm going to take my glasses off. So you may see me putting them on and off because I can't really see anything right now other than the papers that are that are right in front of me. So that'll be a little bit odd, but, you know, it's either mask or glasses. I chose, if you give me the middle finger, I'll have no idea. So that's all, it's all good. All right, so please make sure all your electronic devices are turned off. Today is the most important meeting we will have this session because it represents the culmination of all the meetings that we have had up until this point, highlighting various areas as we've looked in to multiple aspects of the K through 12 budget. Between the conforming bill, which we will do second, and the my budget recommendations, which I'm about to share, you will see all of the ideas and all of the issues that we have discussed come up in all of them. So we're going to start with our FY 2021-2022 pre-K through 12 budget, my recommendations, which will be voted on next week at the Appropriations Committee. And then we're going to do something special, which I did not do in my previous 2 years chairing higher ed. I'm going to present a proposal for reversions, for changes to our current fiscal year 2020-2021 budget, where we go back and claim some money out of there. And there's some pretty dramatic changes in that. And then after I present both of these budget recommendations and answer any questions that folks may have, I will turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Bell so that I can present our conforming bill, PCB PKA 2101. So with that, let's dive right into it. So you should have a spreadsheet, a packet, looks sort of like this, and we're just gonna go through that. Page one of the spreadsheet is a summary by budget entity of my recommended FY 2021-2022 pre-K through 12 budget. The total budget is $19.4 billion, which is an increase of $2.7 billion over the current base year budget, the largest education funding increase, we believe, in Florida history. Almost the entirety of this increase is attributable to the appropriation of the second round of federal ESSER funds. And so that is an important thing that I'll be highlighting repeatedly in this budget. We are reverting to the traditional separation of powers model that we've used for many years, where the legislature receives the money and appropriates it, and then the executive branch spends it. So we will be taking in and appropriating all of that second round ESSER money, in effect, the money that was voted on by the federal government in December. So that's the summary page, but the next pages really get into the details. Pages 2 and 3 will be Representative Alupis's favorite pages. They are the funding recommendations for the early learning services budget entity. Some highlights include we've eliminated 4 positions that have been vacant for 180 days or more, but we are appropriating the full amount of the Office of Early Learning's second round of coronavirus response and relief supplemental funds, which is almost $635 million. That's money we have received from the federal government, and then we are going to appropriate it in a lump sum, which will require the Office of Early Learning to submit budget amendments that include detailed spending plans that comply with all federal requirements. No more of, hey, here's a giant chunk of money, have fun. I mean, now they're going to have to come to us with plans for how they wish to spend the money. $100 million in child care development block grant trust funds for school readiness rate increases based on the plan submitted this fiscal year. And by the way, these two things I've mentioned, the $635 million you'll find on line 16B, and the $100 million in child care development block grant trust funds you'll find on row 25C. So that's sort of the highlight of early learning. Page 4 is the FEFP, and that's just the summary page. The interesting page that you want to look at is the page at the end of your budget spreadsheet, which is our detailed FEFP summary. So let's Let's go to that page. Some highlights that I want to include, I want to focus on that. We are budgeting, assuming a decline of 48,263 students based on projections that have been made. So we believe that we will have fewer students than we have had, and we are reverting to the model of funding education based on actual students and not... I'm sorry?
Representative Fine, what page are you on?
I am on, I should be on the last page of... What? After page 12. Sorry, my packet's a little bit different than yours. It should be an up and down page, not a side to side page.
I found it.
Florida Education Finance Program.
This one, right?
No worries. Yes, I'm gonna take questions on the budget as in general at the end. But if you've got a
no, that was the question. When did you want us?
Yep,
to ask?
We'll do questions on the budget at the end of the presentation. So we're reverting to the model of funding based on actual attendance, not phantom attendance. So the budget assumes a 48,263 student decline, but the total FEFP is a $22.6 billion amount. You'll see that down there at the bottom under total funding, which is an increase of $139.7 million over the current year. It is important to note, though, that $334 million is now allocated to a new student reserve allocation. This is something that we have created in case the 48,263 number is wrong and students come back. So we've set aside $334 million to have money available in case students return, and it can be distributed to school districts if either the October or February FTE surveys include an increase in FTE over the appropriated number of FTE. The base student allocation in this budget increases by $52.11. You will see at the bottom that there are two lines for total funds per student. There's a $181.38 increase in total funds per student, calculated if we include the $334 million reserve, and it's $63.73 if we do not include that amount. Some other changes that I would focus on, we're proposing increasing the mental health assistance allocation by $20 million. We are also proposing, and this will be in my conforming bill, we are proposing eliminating several categoricals, the largest of which are the $68 billion funding compression and hold harmless allocation, the turnaround supplemental services allocation, and then there's a little one for virtual education contribution. Those funds have been moved up into the base student allocation funds. In addition, we've added $265.5 million to the supplemental academic instruction allocation. This increase is to be used exclusively by school districts to assist in the acquisition or provision of additional academic resources or services needed to remediate student learning loss. That is in addition to a lot of the federal money as well, which we will be getting to a little bit later, but lots of money to help schools make sure kids are caught up. And finally, we are making a reduction to the class size allocation to align with the compliance requirements, which we have not been doing. We have been funding it in an amount greater than we needed to. We're going to move it in terms to be in compliance, and that would reduce this allocation by $334.4 million. And that, again, is the summary of our FEFP plan. Now you should flip back in your packets to the pages starting, it's pages 5 through 8 for the state grants, non-FEFP. This is where you'll find the funding of 32 appropriations project bills that I'm recommending be funded out of 95 that were proposed to this committee. I'm also recommending to restore the non-recurring funds for the Seed School in Miami and redirect the $7.6 million that is presently in the Reading Scholarship Accounts Program to HB3. In the conforming bill, we will be proposing eliminating that program and the New Worlds Reading Initiative. That's on row 61A, and we're going to restore the $42 million in school hardening grants on row 88D. You'll also see a $21 million increase in Gardner scholarships to provide funds for eligible students on the wait list, which I'm very pleased to propose. Page 9 is our federal grants K-12 programs budget entity, and this is where you're going to see my recommendations for the appropriation of $1.8 billion of the $2.8 billion of the round 2 ESSER funds. Again, as I said before, we're proposing to revert to traditional methods of appropriation, and so we are proposing to appropriate that money. Specifically, we learned when we had the superintendents in here that there really are some students missing. I mean, some it's paperwork and everything else, but there really are some children who are not attending school. And so we are going to require that $112.3 million of the round two ESSER funds be used exclusively by school districts to locate and evaluate the well-being of any unaccounted for students. This is the 78,000 that we talked about previously. That's row 5A of that page. In addition, at that same meeting, superintendents all agreed that there was learning loss. And it makes sense. I mean, any of you who are keeping your kids at home, I tried it with my son for 2 weeks doing quote unquote e-learning. It did not work very well. And so we know that there are some learning loss issues related to COVID. And so we want to make sure that money is actually being spent on that. So again, of the federal funds, we're going to appropriate $561.6 million, specifically earmarked for FY21-22. That is row 5B. In addition, we're going to appropriate $140.4 million of the round two ESSER funds on the acquisition of educational technology. That is row 5C. And the balance, $993.8 million, will be appropriated to a lump sum appropriation category. School districts will be required to submit detailed spending plans that comply with all federal requirements, not just sort of slush fundy kind of money. So that's how we're going to deal with the 1.8 of the 2.8 billion. We'll get to the other billion in a little while. For education, media, and technology on page 10, including our friends who are broadcasting us right now, they won't have to turn off the cameras because there are no proposed changes to the current year budget. And finally, on pages 11 and 12 is my recommended budget for the State Board of Education. Highlights of this budget include a reduction of about $5.3 million associated with cutting 91 positions that have been vacant for 180 days or more. Funds associated with two bills that we heard and unanimously passed in our subcommittee, and that includes HB 3, the New World's Reading Initiative, and Representative Alupis's Literacy Bill, HB 7011. You're making out great today. Rows 17B and 25C. In addition, we are going to use some backfilling. In addition to the $2.8 billion, that school districts were sent by the federal government. Money was also spent for the DOE, and we're going to shift about $84.6 million from general revenue funds to federal ESSER funds and use those federal ESSER funds to backfill some of that. With the balance of the department's round two ESSER, which totals about $173.6 million, appropriated in a lump sum appropriation category, with release contingent, again, upon submission of detailed spending plans that comply with all federal requirements. Again, reasserting the legislature's traditional role of appropriating all funds. Members, these are the highlights of the pre-K through 12 appropriation budget. As a subcommittee, we do not vote on these recommendations. So my proposed budget will be provided to Chair Trumbull and the full Appropriations Committee. The next stop for this budget is at the Appropriations Committee meeting on Wednesday, March 30th. And before I answer questions on this, and I'm happy to do so, I just wanted to let folks know we got information today, just so folks know and just get this information out there. The recent, third round of alleged COVID relief that the federal government is borrowing a couple trillion dollars to give us, Florida is going to get, I have it right here, $7,038 million and change of that money. And today they are releasing $4,692,164,292 to us so that we can reopen schools. Unfortunately, we can't go back in time. They're already open, but they still chose to borrow that money from our children in order to give it to us. That money, neither the 4.6 or the 7 billion is contemplated in this budget because we just got the numbers today. But over the next 6 weeks, I think we intend to again make clear that, like all federal funds that come to the state, they will pass through the legislature and we will appropriate them. So there's another ridiculous amount of money coming from the federal government, borrowed from the same people, our children, that they allege to want to help. And with that, I'm happy to answer questions about the budget. I got to put on my glasses or I can't see you. All right. Here we got that. Yes, Representative Bartleman, you're recognized for a question.
I have a concern about the holding harmless, the elimination of holding harmless.
Can't hear you, and, Robert.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you guys hear me now? Okay. I have a concern about the elimination of the holding harmless. And also, in the next bill, we're going to have the declining enrollment categorical removed. And so my concern is that what that does is, if you have to wait to October FTE, you're going to lay off a lot of teachers and staff at the beginning of the year, especially with that declining enrollment categorical lost. And then you're going to have to wait to hire them, correct?
Thank you for the, I didn't know there was a question, but to respond, that's the current process? That's how it works right now?
But you had declining enrollment that we're going to remove.
We haven't been doing it for a while. And and the other thing is that, again, they're sitting on tons of ESSER money that is available to deal with these kinds of issues. Remember, they will still have 1.8 of the $2.8 billion of federal money. So there's plenty of money available for school districts. I would note that as of today, round one money, which was only $700 million, which is still a huge amount of money, but when you're comparing it to $2.8 billion, the local politicians have only spent 51% of that $700 million at this point, with another $2.8 billion, of which we're going to be sending them $1.8 billion. So they are drowning in cash, and that shouldn't be an issue.
Can I ask a follow-up, sir?
You can ask a question.
Okay. So the question is, are you going to allow in the plans, because funding teacher positions, like permanent teacher positions, are reoccurring dollars. So when we know that kids are going to be coming back, and we want to anticipate that, so we're not laying, because people are going to be laying off teachers at the beginning of the year, is the Department of Education going to give the flexibility to hire the permanent positions with the ESSER funds that are non-reoccurring?
I would suggest that, like any entity that expects fewer customers, that they should act accordingly. Again, we're going to get a new count here fairly soon. This 48,000 decline is based on the October count, correct? So we're going to get the new count, and that's part of why we've set aside that $300 million plus. So as we go through the budgeting process continuing over the next 6 weeks, if it appears that 48,000 number is going to be lower because the students have come back by February, then we'll be making those changes as well. But if students do not return because they have chosen to homeschool or they have chosen to go on to virtual school options, fewer teachers will be needed, and there will be fewer teachers.
Can I ask one more follow-up?
Last follow-up.
Thank you. So what I think is going to happen in my district is kids are going to return, and we're going to lay off a group of teachers because we're going to go based on the enrollment during the quarantine pandemic. We already see people pushing back in. And my fear is, if you have to wait to the October FTE, your classrooms are going to be overcrowded with kids, with not enough teachers, and then you have the reserve set aside. Would there be any way for you to release those dollars earlier to mitigate those issues that may occur in some of the districts?
Thank you. I challenge the premise of your question is the count is based on lockdown quarantine numbers. That is incorrect. The budget will ultimately be based on the count that was done in February. We have not been in a lockdown in the state for 7 or 8 months. So are there additional questions? Representative Williams, did you have a question?
Just a general question, sir. According to the programs that has been chosen to be funded, how were they actually chosen?
There's a lot of programs in this budget. I don't understand.
In general, how were they actually chosen? Because we have 120 members, and I think we have about 10 different programs that's here that has been funded in this budget, and several of them was funded year before last and the following year also.
I think, is your question relating to member projects?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So as I said in my opening comments, we had 95 member project requests. We've been able to fund, I have recommended the funding of 32 of them. How was that decision made? It was using my judgment. Obviously, I should know the number. I don't. Maybe staff does. I didn't look it up, but we didn't hear all 95. So if you weren't one of the projects we heard, we did hear most. I don't know, but I would imagine it was north of 60. So we funded about half of the projects that were eligible to be funded, and it was based on my judgment. And I also had, I had a limited amount of money that I could use to make those recommendations, and I used my judgment in how to do it. But it was 32 projects, not 10.
Okay.
Yep, you're welcome. Yes, you're recognized.
Okay, I just want to make sure, because if a member is going to put in projects every session when they come, and only a certain amount is going to be funded, I just want to know, what's the purpose of us putting in, to just show that we put them in, or come up and practice that we're putting in projects for our districts and they're not funded? I'm just trying to find the process. What determines a project being chosen versus one not being chosen? Is it a wording that you're looking for, or the need for the district that the program is offering? I'm just trying to find what should be put in the project so that you would be funding on the followings.
Sure. I will tell you how I did it, and obviously every there are seven of us. I'd also note, before I answer this question, this is just the first step in the process. These are not final numbers. This is just a starting point. The Senate released their budget yesterday. They'll have their own sense of member projects, and there will be, you know, a bunch of changes between now and when we get this done. Here, the way I did it, and you'll see this in there, is I was given a certain allocation of money to spend. I chose not to fund any. It was different than prior years. When I was chair of higher education, and I was given, I was given $8 million when I had that chairmanship. And if I wanted to keep a lot of member projects alive, I could give them $50,000 or $100,000 to do placeholders. Under the rules that all of us voted for, we rejected that methodology unanimously, I believe, of appropriating that way. None of us wanted to do that anymore. And we moved to a policy that said no member project could be funded at an amount of less than 50% of the ask, which that in and of itself, even if I had that same $8 million, I would be able to fund many fewer projects, because you can't put in $100,000 when someone's asking for $1 million. You will see, I think with rare exception, no project has been funded at this point in the budget at any amount over 50%, including, by the way, my brainchild that I came up with 5 years ago, the security funding for Jewish day schools. I didn't even fund that at more than 50% at this point in the budget. It's not my project. It was Representative Caruso's project, but it's obviously one that I care very passionately about. So I did that in order to make the pipe go as wide as I could. And then I had a certain amount of money. And I will tell you, I did it based on what I thought about the projects. And also the amount of money was relevant. You know, once projects were over a certain dollar amount, I thought, look, if I had had $5 million, $1 million project, if I had to put in $500,000, would take 10% of the pot. So all other things being equal, smaller requests were looked upon more favorably than larger requests, so I could do more. And then it was a chairman's prerogative to do that. I would note that if folks don't agree with the budget or the projects, the Rules Committee will be voting later today on an amendment process that people can take advantage of. I don't think it happens very often, but this is my recommendation, and I used my judgment to put it together. I'll come back. Do you have another question?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Valdez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair Fine. In reference to the ESSER dollars, are we using non-recurring dollars like the ESSER dollars for recurring costs in this proposed budget? And
No, we are not. No.
Follow-up question?
Yep, you're recognized.
Thank you. And just for clarification, and I heard that you said that there's going to be an amendment process voted on later on today with the Rules Committee. Considering these ESSER dollars that are in abundance, do you think that maybe some of the member projects that may not necessarily be ongoing may have another consideration?
This was my judgment on how to fund member projects today. Again, I was able to partially, I don't think I fully funded any, maybe one or two if there was a little rounding error, but, you know, I funded a third of the requests, and I believe about half of the ones that we heard as a committee. So I'm actually very pleased with how far we were able to go based on a relatively small amount of money. But remember, if we take ESSER money and we use it to fund member projects, we're reducing home rule authority because we're taking it away from local school boards. So you have to make that trade-off. Do you want home rule, or do you want Tallahassee to make member project spending decisions? This is what I decided for now.
Thank you.
I didn't think
about it that way, yep. But yeah, you're right, because this money is supposed to go directly to the district. So thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome. Are there Ranking Member Wilhite, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I wouldn't, I would have to disagree with you a little bit that I don't think local school districts are swimming in money right now, and that the federal government has allocated, either the previous administration or this administration have allocated CARES dollars or federal funding to our states to help in areas. And so I would guess, I would ask, it was part of that aspect, are we using calculations from December's revenues to predict our budget currently, and as we go forward, because as we've seen that everyone is saying the state is doing well and things are doing well, will there be new allocation, new revenues estimated that then this budget will be reevaluated and maybe potentially there'll be more areas funded?
So we have to use the most recent revenue estimating conference, which was December. There will be another one over the next few weeks, and certainly if those things change, we, you know, this is the first step in a long process. This is my recommendation, which Chair Trumbull will consider as he puts forward the budget and appropriations next week. That'll be week 5, week 6. Then we'll vote on the budget on the floor, most likely. And then there's obviously the whole conference process. And there will be more data. I talked about the biggest change that just happened this morning, the fact that apparently we're going to get the largest wire transfer, I think, in the history of the state of Florida today, of $4.6 billion from the federal government. When we were working on this a week ago, we didn't know that money was going to be released. So it is a moving target. But I will tell you, this proposed budget is by far the largest education budget proposed in the history of the state, by far. And it's because of the federal largesse.
Yep. Yes, and so if the first round of member projects were allocated to 32 member projects, as we go forward, do you potentially have a second round, or have already looked at what your next potential member projects would be, if you could fund more moving forward if we recognize that our revenues have increased in this next round?
Generally, the way the process works is I'll revisit, and this is the case for everyone, I'll revisit member projects when we go to conference. I mean, okay. And so, you know, I would say the universe of projects is the ones that I've funded, as well as the ones that that Senator Broxson has funded in his budget, and those will be different. And I haven't had a chance really to review his yet, but that will really be the next time that we take a look at that.
Thank you, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yep, you're welcome.
So those were just some of the 20,000 feet questions. Getting down to a little bit more, you talk about that the individual school districts will have money used from to locate students. When we first started, we talked about a round number of 90. It was really like 88. And then we found out there was other school districts, and we heard from the superintendents that they were finding students. And so the money that's allocated for them to find students, is there a number or a percentage or that they get down to if they locate those students that money could be reallocated for other purposes? I mean, I don't expect to get to zero, but if they found 80%, 85% of their students, the money that's supposed to be used to find those students and work towards those students, could that money be reallocated for something else then, or where will it go?
Sure, it's a great question. The money is not just for locating the students. It's sort of a little bit more holistic for after they've been found as well. So it's not just once you found them, you're done. They can be spent on more than just that.
Okay. And then just another follow-up, if you don't mind, sir.
Yep, you're right.
It talks about another $500 million for teacher salary increase allocation. Obviously, we've heard a little bit over the years about teacher compression, and I'm a little concerned about where we get in the teacher compression aspect of senior teachers and keeping them in employment. Is that enough to work on, or does it have to just be teacher salary hiring for their increase? Is some of this going to be used for increasing salaries over time?
Thanks for the question. Local politicians decide on teacher pay, not us here in the legislature. We're simply maintaining that $500 million that we gave them last year to help them raise base teacher pay, but that is a decision, as our former school board members know, of the local school boards to decide what they choose to pay teachers. And they don't all make the same, even for the same, you know, the exact same person, in two different school districts don't get paid the same. We do not dictate teacher pay. That's a decision. That's a home rule decision.
Okay.
Maybe we should, but I'll get a nasty look down there by saying that. But no, that's a home rule call.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think this is round one. I look forward to hopefully us being able to work on some more, because I believe that, you know, you said Well, I'm getting into debate. Let me give you another question on that topic then. As we go through, I think the first round of CARES Act money has been allocated and used. Is it going to be the same process, if you said they've only used 51% now, the same process for requesting that money as the second, as this big round of wire transfer you talk comes in? Will it be the same process for getting that money and utilizing it?
Yeah, thank you. Here it is. Got to take my glasses off. It's 51%. In fact, there are only 7 counties that have spent more than 80% and only one that is more than 90%. But I know why it's important to you. Your county, Palm Beach, is one of those 7. They have spent 88% of their money. But the average today is 51% that has been dispersed. The process will be slightly different because now we are appropriating the money out and putting some guidelines in place, which has not been the case for that first $700 of CARES Act, which was granted basically after we left session last year and we didn't come back to appropriate it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Lupus, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a few, if you permit me, just quick questions.
Sure.
So I keep hearing these huge amounts of money that are coming to Florida. In totality, what is coming into our state, you know, through all of the different stimulus programs?
I believe about 12, I think it's about $12 billion.
Just follow up?
That's if I think about the 3 rounds, if I think about what both the school districts are getting, as well as the state, as well as the early learning money, I think it's about between these 3, again, I think about it in terms of like when it was done. So you've got the sort of March of last year. That was when what we call the $700 million, that was more than that. It was $700 million plus money to the state plus early learning, $700 million. Then there was December, both of these done under President Trump. That's where the $2.8 billion plus another $300 million for DOE plus early learning money. And then, as I said, we just got the official memo of another $7 billion. Of which $4.6 billion is being released today. I think when you add it all up between those 3 buckets, it's about $12 billion.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
And of the $12 billion, and maybe Ms. Poppin can help with this, is that inclusive of the $2.5 billion that's coming in for early learning?
Yes.
Okay. Do we have any idea how these dollars are going to be used? Have you had any conversations with the school district? Understand? I mean, it's an enormous amount of money.
I think early, as you've seen, we have not done a real presentation in here on early learning. And if that's something you want to work on with me over the next few weeks, I'd be happy to. I think there is more work that we can do to dig into that.
And I would say this, Chair, and you and I are friends. I appreciate your attention to this issue. And my only ask is, in my committee, we had one of the chancellors come talking about child care centers that are open and sort of celebrating that 98% of child care centers are open in the state. And I sort of qualified. I said they are barely open. They're sort of hanging on by a thread. So I would be grateful if part of this conversation is trying to figure out how to make sure that those dollars get into those centers as quickly as possible, because it's a very different system from the K-12 system. Mm-hmm. These are small private businesses that are literally going day by day just trying to remain open and serving the families and the children that they do. So just would appreciate that as part of the conversation moving forward.
Well, let's work on that together over the next few weeks.
We'll do.
Yes, Representative McLean, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 2 questions. One, on the Regional Education Consortium, where you removed that $1,750,000, can you just walk me through that a little bit and how maybe that's going to be funded going forward?
Can you, which line?
It's 45A.
Yeah, which page is it again?
It's on page 6, and then it's line 45A.
Okay. The reason that we remove that is that the benefit of that program is to local school boards. We were just sort of paying the dues for them, and we've made the decision if they think it's a valuable thing to do that they can pay the dues directly, make it a home rule call and not a state mandate.
Thank you. One more question.
Yep.
Thank you. Also, we funded some new school construction projects, I believe, in the last budget cycle, and I don't see them. I thought we had to continue to carry those until they were finished. I don't think I see them on here.
Yeah, all that stuff is through full appropriations. That's like PICO.
Oh, okay, okay.
All that sort of stuff. Yeah, we don't, I did that. They let me do it in higher ed last year because of all the changes that we were making there. But that those issues are handled at the full appropriations. The only thing that we have that's sort of capital-y in here is you will find that we've restored funding for school hardening.
Right.
But that's not, the building of new schools is a full appropriations PICO PICO issue.
I couldn't remember where it was in the budget. Thanks.
Any additional questions? Representative Bartleman.
Thank you, Chair. I first want to say thank you for letting school districts have the discretion to use their ESSER funds. I think that's a good call. So thank you. I wanted to reframe my question because I'm trying to wrap my head around how this is going to work.
So, I can't see you anyway, so just talk into the microphone.
It's so rude not to look at you.
It's okay. I have no idea what you're, I can't see you anyway.
Okay, that's
so it's fine.
Okay, so I need to wrap my head around how it's going to look in the beginning of the year. So that February FTE will generate the numbers for the funding for when we open schools. There are two things that can happen. Kids will remain where they are, or like a lot of families that I know who put their children in virtual, they're planning on coming back when the school year starts. So there is a possibility that there will be an influx of kids. Based on the February numbers, there is a possibility in large districts like Dade and Palm Beach and Broward that we would have to then lose teachers, pack the classrooms. There is no more categorical for declining enrollment to protect us. And then you're gonna have this, this reserve. So would they have to wait for the October FTE count to get the money to get those teachers back? Or, and I still don't understand how the ESSER could be used to hire the permanent positions. So can someone, just so I understand it, I'm very, And I, when I was talking about COVID lockdown, I meant that this year was different. A lot of parents I know said, I'm doing virtual all year. I'll go back next year. So that's what I was referring to. So can you help me understand how that's going to work operationally for districts who are getting ready to open?
Sure. So we're not making a change. It wasn't funded this year. So it's not, we're not taking away that funding. So we're not making any changes. Like I said, this will be funded based on, this will be redone once we have the February numbers. You know, we're not putting in a new, we've put in a budget mechanism that doesn't exist right now for if a whole bunch of students show up. And so that exists. I will also challenge, these are not permanent positions. Teachers are hired from year to year. So I think that's an important thing to note. It's not a position that you get and you have forever. I mean, I hope they do if they're good teachers, but that's not how it works. And so we've created a $334 million reserve for exactly the issue that you have raised. But we find out what the student count is in October, and that's the way the process works. And so we have put in money to try to solve for that problem. And I've also told you we will update this accordingly. But I will tell you in the base student allocation, even with the declining enrollment, the base student allocation is going up. So they're not getting less money, theoretically. I mean, I guess depending on where they shake out, net-net, they're not getting less money in the base student allocation. And again, if a bunch of students show up, then we'll have to deal with that. But again, these are the challenges that folks have to make. So, I mean, we don't have that money today, and we've created a solution to the problem that you have suggested in the budget as presented.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Is there any mechanism, one more follow-up? Mm-hmm. Because imagine a very large kindergarten class having to sit like that till October, to after the count, because teachers are funded by FTE. Is there any mechanism or rule that could be put in place to allow that funding to happen sooner if there's just like a huge influx? Like, because I know what you're saying, it's funded through FTE in October, but that's a long time to wait. A lot of schools start in the beginning of August.
Well, I mean, the only idea, and again, this is free base thinking here, but you know, we could talk about the idea of the October count is it's supposed to be the beginning of the school year count. I mean, it gives the school district some time to kind of find anybody who doesn't show up on day one. I guess that might be something that we can think about is maybe moving up the date of that count and making it earlier. And that would have other problems. Any student who wasn't there on day one wouldn't get counted. But this is why we have. This is why we have done it this way. Again, we're projecting 48,000 decline. That's over a very, very large number of people. I think I want to, with all due respect, I think we are overstating, I think you're overly concerned with the problem. The net decline is 1.67%. Okay. So the idea of like, we're going to have classrooms exploding. I mean, the difference between us expecting 99% of the people to show up and 100% of the people to show up, I don't think we're going to have the kinds of issues. If we were projecting like a 30% decline, then yeah, you could have that problem. But even 48,000 sounds like a big number because it is across the state, but it's a less than 2% expectation. So I don't think it's going to be as big a problem as you're concerned with. Okay. Are there any additional questions? Yes, Ranking Member Wilhite.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the second bite at the apple. I just wondered if you could, when you do your estimations of students for next year, obviously we're only doing that on historical and speculative, but we're also seeing the effects of people moving to Florida. Here, mine are doing the same thing. Yours are. We're seeing the number of people moving to Florida a day. And are we using those calculations of those numbers of potential students? Now, I get that every 1,000 people moving here, you know, it's 2.13 or whatever, so maybe, you know, a family and a student, a child of school age. Are we using those calculations of our numbers that could be increasing in our schools on those calculations you're talking about coming back? Because obviously, as we've all talked about this year, it's a little different because we had a lot of kids go out that were already here that could be coming back, but then we have to add in that potentially new growth into Florida, and we're adding those into that as well?
I don't make the estimates. This isn't like Randy didn't sit in his room and go figure out. And these numbers come from the Revenue Estimating Conference, and they are, you know, professional predictors, and I believe they factor, because the population growth is not new. We've typically been adding about 1,000 people a day in Florida, and I'm certain that's part of what they factor in when they do their estimates, but we do not make the number. That 48,000 number is a number that comes to us from a nonpartisan, you know, group that does that. That's what they do for us. But I don't make those guesses.
Okay, just follow up.
Yep.
It just seems unusual, like you say, how we can show an increase when the increase of Florida's population is going up. And you know, we saw there was a lot of kids that went to virtual versus just in classrooms. But if it is factual that as we come up with more scientific data and immunizations and those things, that a lot of those kids potentially would be going back to bricks and mortar. You know, for instance, I guess my two are at home in school, but logically they'll probably go back, hopefully, and a lot of other people feel that. So I'm just seeing, it seems unusual that as we say things are getting better and opening it up, continue to open up in Florida and new people moving here, that how we would have such a decrease in kids.
Well, I would note that, again, this number came from December. We had 78,000 that were gone, and yet they only told us to plan for 48,000. And I think that's part of it. And I do think we will see. I'm just, again, you're talking about your kids. I'll talk about mine. I will tell you, at my son's school where he's going, I will tell you, between October and February, a whole lot of people showed back up because people got tired of trying to educate their kids at home. So I think you're going to see a meaningful change when that comes out. But again, that is our process. It's not a political decision on how that number is generated. That's a, you know, academic forecasted number by people who do that for a living.
Okay. And then just one more follow-up, if you don't mind, sir.
Yep.
Could you, and obviously anybody that looks at a spreadsheet, a budget sheet, looks at things and they look at the highs and lows. And on your long spreadsheet, you're up and down, you said after page 12, could you just highlight the ones? I mean, when you see 100% decrease in three areas and you see a increase of 39% or 34% in some areas, could you kind of just give an idea of why there's such a big wave or change in those areas? Because, again, you know, most people, when they do their budgets, they like to see a flat line,
sure,
not highs and lows. If you could just kind of explain a couple of those.
And like you're referring to the one that says Florida Education Finance Program at the top?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah, there's one up at 34 and 39, and then three down at 100%.
So I talked about that in my opening comments. I'll just go through the big ones, if you will, in order. So the 39.79, I mean, again, it's only $10 million, and it has to do based on just visitation. Let's focus on the ones that have big percentages and big numbers. The ones I think you're focused on, the 34.46%, the supplemental academic instruction, I talked about how we chose to put extra money into that for learning loss. That's one of the things I mentioned in my opening remarks. The three that are going down by 100%, that is to implement, that assumes the conforming bill that we're going to take up soon, where we're eliminating those categoricals, and those funds have been shifted up into the base student allocation. So we're trying to reduce complexity in how the budget works, and we just thought these three didn't really add a whole lot to the process, but we didn't delete the money. We just pushed it into the main pot. And so that's why those are going down 100%.
I promise my last question.
Yep.
In one of our last presentations, we had a lot of reading programs talked about that weren't used, or maybe you talked about consolidating. So is that somewhere in this budget where you've talked about doing that with those?
Yeah, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, we're proposing, and it will be in the conforming bill, eliminating the reading scholarship program and phasing it out. But we also do fund Representative Alupis's literacy bill, and we do fund the new reading initiative where children are being sent books. And so those are all assumed to be funded in the budget. Are there any other questions before we move into the reversions? It's only one sheet. Oh, yes, Representative Valdez, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. In that same sheet that we are looking at with the Florida Education Finance Program, where we talk about the turnaround supplemental services allocation for those schools that we 100% removed from the budget, this has been... I'm wondering how do you foresee in these high need schools that are constantly struggling with performance, how can we continue to support these children in these particular schools by rolling in? I just think that there's an equity problem there that could be, because these kids, these students that are going to these schools really need a lot more support. So if we wrap those dollars into the base student allocation, it's spread out through the whole system. Whereas in these particular schools that we have seen of high needs may not have those resources available. So I'm wondering how, under this budget proposal, how do you think that we could support those children in those schools and continue? Because one of the things that I see is that once they get that certain schools get to a certain level of proficiency and they're doing well, and we wind up removing those resources, 9 times out of 10 they're going to revert back because of just the situation of that school. So I'm concerned about the equity aspect of this particular allocation being removed.
Thank you. This is going to be the last question because we have to move on and vote on the conforming bill. We are going to trust school board members like you two used to be, where this money goes, and this is a home rule. We're increasing home rule to allow school boards to make those decisions. We're not taking away those funds. We're giving it to them, and if that's what they think is the right decision, using that home rule discretion, they'll be able to do that. But we are not eliminating the funds for the program. With that, I'm going to move on because we have to wrap up by 1 o'clock. Sorry, I like answering everybody's questions. I do need to very quickly go through, if I can find it here. You should have another page in your packet. Which page is it in their packet? The very last page in your packet is the 2020 reversions and 2020-2021 reversions. And what that means is this is money that's in the current year that we are going to capture and bring back. This includes my recommendation. So state agencies at Governor DeSantis's at Governor DeSantis's order held back 6% of their current fiscal year budget as a result of the coronavirus. We are going to claim that 6% that he set aside. And so those are reductions. And then there are other appropriations that are unlikely to be spent before the current year. So for example, things like $70 million for kids who didn't go to VPK, for example. And then we're taking $150 million from the Schools of Hope carry forwards that are not being used for the Schools of Hope. And then we are going to take $1 billion of the $2.8 billion of ESSER and use it to supplant state funding for the current year. So we will be taking $1.252 billion from the current year and bringing that funding forward to this year. I'll take one or two questions on that, and then we have to move on to the conforming bill. All right, seeing none, we're going to move on to the conforming bill. I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Bell.
Thank you, Chair Fine. You are now recognized to explain PCB PKE 21-01.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I'm pleased to present PCB PKA 2101, which is the conforming bill, to go along with my budget recommendations. This bill will create applicable statutes to go along with the budget. A number of things that it does is it modifies funding for Florida Virtual School so that they will now get the mental health assistance allocation. They have not previously gotten that. That will fix that issue. It also modifies virtual instruction. You'll remember we did a presentation on that, and we found some issues with virtual instruction. It's going to say that all school districts have to have at least one option for part and full-time virtual education. It explains what a school district will have to do with any difference in funds between what they receive for a virtual student and what they spend on a provider in order to provide that virtual education. And it will limit the enrollment of virtual students residing from outside of a school district to no more than 50% of the total enrolled virtual students residing inside the school district. As you saw, we had this sort of student laundering issue in a number of counties that really raised a number of eyebrows. This will end that issue. It also modifies the FEFP. It eliminates the requirement that the 300 lowest performing elementary schools on the state reading assessment must use their portion of the SAI allocation on an additional hour per day of reading instruction. We're doing that because it's elsewhere, and another one of the allocations doesn't need to be said twice. And then we're repealing a number of the allocations, as I just described as I went through the budget. We're repealing the Reading Scholarship Accounts Program. We discussed that one when we did our literacy presentation. We're talking about how increases to minimum base, this proposes a change to how increases in the minimum base salary of instructional personnel on the performance salary schedule link back to other people's salary. And then it's going to create these new allocations for part of the ESSER funding, a non-enrollment assistance allocation and an academic acceleration allocation that is consistent with the budget that I have proposed. And that's an overview of the conforming bill.
Thank you, Chair Fine. Members, there are no amendments on this bill. Are there any questions?
I see lots of hands going up.
Chair Barber. So are we going to be eliminating the lowest 300 then and the turnaround? Are we getting rid of the testing and all of those things since we're not going to have that?
You're recognized.
And the grades?
Thank you. We're eliminating the requirement to do this 300 thing because it is a requirement in another allocation as well. It's sort of a duplication. So it's still going to be a requirement. It's just not going to be a requirement in two separate allocations.
So can I ask a follow-up, ma'am?
A follow-up.
I'm going back. So the lowest 300 enables schools to have the extra hour and the turnaround service. All of that is part of the turnaround services. It all has to do with equity. Where else is it funded? Because when I read the bill, you're taking a categorical and moving it to a BSA. So base student allocation follows the kid, not the school. So when you take the $45 million, which would give those high-need kids for equity $500 more to provide the services, and you disperse it across the BSA, that's only $16 a kid. So that's not equity. So I'm trying to understand how the school districts are going to have local control to find that money, when the point of that was extra money to give to the schools to really help the neediest kids. Putting in the BSA, that money has to follow each individual child.
You're recognized, Chair Fine.
Yeah, I didn't hear a question. That sounded a lot like debate to me.
Okay.
I'm happy to answer questions, though.
Yeah. What is your question, Representative Barnard?
How are you planning to help and create equity in the neediest schools by returning those dollars to the BSA when those neediest kids are only going to get $16 more in the BSA?
Okay. Recognized.
Thank you. There's nothing that says that as that money is put in the base student allocation, it needs to be distributed on a basis of $16. If you don't trust the home rule authority of local school boards, that's certainly an issue that we can address here in other ways, but we're putting it in there. And we are continuing to have that requirement. It's just in a different categorical. It's in there twice today.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Fine. Okay. Ranking Member Will Hyde. Oh.
Can you tell me the categorical, please, sir?
It's in the reading instruction categorical.
Okay.
So again, the requirement is not eliminated. It's just eliminated in two different categoricals, but it's still there. Hasn't changed.
Thank you. Moving on to Representative Will Hyde, ranking member.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Chair Fine, I guess this is a little bit obviously about the conversation we had about the reading programs, and when something that says repeals, that means they're not going to be there because we're getting rid of them. So when that money, when relating to those scholarship accounts, how will people that are specifically in need of additional reading for their child going to get additional funding to help them in the area of reading if those reading scholarships aren't available?
Chair Fine.
Thank you. And Representative Lupus might speak to this in debate when we get to that. But we're eliminating this program. And to be clear, as we talked about at the time, the program is not very popular with folks. I'm just trying to find the data here real quickly. I mean, in the first year, we allocated $10 million. 72% of the funding was not used. In the second year, we allocated $7.6 million, and over half the funding was not used. In the third year, we funded $7.6 million again, and 80% of the funding was not used. It's simply a program that parents have rejected, and we are taking that money, and we are using it to fund different literacy initiatives. Again, we're funding Representative Lupus's literacy bill that he shared earlier, as well as the program, as the speaker's vision to send books into people's homes for those who are having reading deficiencies. So we're not saying we're not going to focus on literacy. We're just going to shift from a program that has not worked and try some other things.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
You follow up?
So obviously we had a lot of discussion about whether it was, if it was worked or not, and we realize it doesn't, and I think we recognize that maybe, and I'll get to my question, obviously we recognize that maybe everyone did a poor job of it, but again, a literacy program at the beginning or a program that every kid can try and get in school, I'm specifically talking about the ones that need and have availability of getting additional reading assistance. There won't be any of that there for them now, is my understanding. Specifically for that child, if their parent wants to take them and enroll them in a reading program. Is that correct?
What is your question?
Is that correct that there won't be additional funding there for any parent to request that outside of the already bigger literacy programs?
Chair Fine?
Yeah, as we talked about when we did that presentation, I think I stopped counting at 12 different literacy programs that exist. The Reading Scholarship Accounts program will be ending. But as funded in the budget, two new literacy programs will be created in part by using this funding. Parents have generally chosen not to avail themselves of this program.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Chair Williamson? Or Representative Williamson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rep. Fine, when you spoke about the turnaround supplemental programs for the you said you're not eliminating them, but you are moving the money elsewhere. Are we calling it something else, or we're doing away with it altogether?
Fine.
We are eliminating it as an allocation and increasing home rule authority of local school boards. We are not eliminating the funding. Those dollars have been put into the money and increasing the flexibility of local politicians using home rule to spend that money as they best see fit. Something I would think many of the members of the committee, maybe other than me, would like.
Representative Williams?
Chair Fine, I really appreciate that. Next question?
Yes, you're recognized.
On page 27 of the bill itself, it talks about the salary of the 47.5, but you also speaks about 150% for the base salary. Is that flexible? Are you putting that in the hands of local officials to decide on that part of it?
Okay. Chair Fine?
Yes, the local officials have that ability to set how they choose to increase those salaries, but we're simply putting in a formula for that sort of has a secondary effect based on their exercise of their home rule powers.
So they can change to the 150% or the 25% that's mentioned there? They have the ability to do that?
Chair Fine?
The local politicians have the ability to decide how to make annual increases in minimum base salary. Based on how they do that, then that formula that we've described here would work accordingly.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Moving on, there is no public testimony. We'll move into debate. A lot of hands. Representative Featherhall, you're recognized.
Thank you. So I understand that we're eliminating this program and that perhaps there are some districts that are not taking advantage of it, but I have seven of these schools, of these 300 in Volusia County, five of them which are in my district that do take advantage of this. And you talk about home rule and the fact that we're giving it back to the districts to deal with this. We've seen how that's worked in the past, and I'm afraid that that's not going to work for our students that are benefiting from this current program, which we've not even given a chance to see how it works because it only went into effect in 2019-2020. I have concerns about us taking this money away that's being accessed for our children to get the help that they need. I understand we're going to send home books with them, but these kids aren't being addressed at home, their reading concerns. We know that. We know these kids are in need of some great assistance, and that's why these schools are on this list, because these are areas where they just need that extra assistance. And putting it in the general budget, I mean, we wound up having to go out of our way to make sure that teachers got teacher pay by setting it aside specifically for them to get teacher pay, because no matter how much money we put into the budget for that money to go to teacher pay increases, it didn't happen due to home rule. So I have an issue with us creating a program and not letting it work for a little while to see if people would start accessing it before we take it away. So I just have concerns with that. I understand we have other programs that address literacy, and I'm supportive of that. I'm just concerned when we take away a program that we haven't let work for a little while. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Representative Lupus, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just sort of piggybacking off what Representative Featherhoff just mentioned and what Representative Wilhite, Ranking Member Wilhite, mentioned in questioning, I think what I took away from this committee is that there is a fundamental disconnect in all of the programs being provided, right? So you have federal programs, you have state programs. One of the things we did not look at are county-level programs, municipal programs, philanthropic programs, all focused on literacy. And again, I'm not speaking to the merits of the program. They all do fantastic work, I know, and they're all well-intended, but this is a hugely critical issue. And I think at the end of the day, as a state, what I think, as somebody who's worked in this space for a decade, I think what's so critical is that we're finally, as a state, beginning to look at this in a strategic manner and not just throwing money and creating programs, but trying to figure out what is in the best interest of our children and what can we do as a state to ensure that we're making sure that the resources that we have are getting to the students that most need them. I'm not calling into question the merits of the reading scholarship. I know for a fact that it wasn't as utilized as I think people thought. And I don't know if that has to do with it's probably more a reflection of awareness of the program is my guess. So that's, again, a conversation that we can have. And I know Chair Fine to have an open door to discuss these pieces. But I don't want us to get lost on the fact that our chamber is moving forward on literacy policies in the most strategic way I have ever seen in my career. And, again, I think we can talk about giving parents additional resources to support the out-of-school efforts that they need. But this is not a celebration of my bill, but the dollars that are being appropriated to HB 7011 are creating the VPK through 8, you know, progress monitoring tool to identify those struggling readers. It's creating the RAISE program, which is putting funding into school districts for credentialed reading instruction. So, again, we are building this framework to ensure that the dollars that we have are being most properly utilized in a system that I fundamentally feel has been fractured for a long time. Again, not questioning the merits of the program, all well-intended, and some do incredible work, but there's a finite amount of money, and the fact of the matter is we have 43% of students in every one of your school districts. Some may be a little bit better, some may be significantly worse, but you have somewhere between 43 to 45% of your third graders who can't read at grade level. And you get to 10th grade, and you would think it would get better, but you still have 43 to 45% of your 10th graders who can't read at grade level. So I think what this chamber is trying to do is to say what we've been doing hasn't been working, so we need to take a more strategic approach. And I know Representative Trabolsi's bill with HB 3 addresses the books at home component. My piece addresses the professional development for teachers. And again, hitting this issue through all three prongs, I think, is going to be what actually really moves the needle. So I want to give you that context, because it's not just about moving money from here to there. It's really taking a very different and more strategic approach to these critical issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lupus. That was a very exploratory for all of us to understand that we're not taking one program to the other. We'll now have another debate from Chair Barterman.
Hi, thank you, ma'am.
Chair, Vice Chair.
So we have a model here, and it was created years ago based on school accountability, that we judge on one test how the school is graded, how the students are performing. Based on that model, Senator Simmons created a turnaround model and turnaround schools. The point of that was because we know that the kids who are struggling and not reading and need tier two and tier three instruction need that additional money. And as a matter of fact, at one point, the state of Florida funded it at $2,000 per kid. It was only funded, we didn't use it last year, we didn't even do the FSA. It's only at $500 a kid. And this model, I argue, is incredibly successful because as Rep. Valdez stated, the schools, they raise their grades. The kids perform because you're infusing money, it's equity. You're infusing money to meet all of the needs of those children. So when you take away that, and I am still going to, I need to sit down with staff and Chair Fine, because when you say it's going back into the general for schools to use as they want, general is base student allocation. And when I met with FEA and I met with CFOs and we read this bill, that means that money follows the kid. So they're not going to have that extra money to follow the neediest kids. So I would like to sit down with someone and explain to me how I, as a board member, are going to have the discretion to do that. That was it's one of those really successful programs now that we're eliminating. Second, I want to point you all to the
Representative Barterman, you're going to have to wrap it up because we have someone else.
My last comment, the page about teacher salaries. The people who didn't get raises were all the teachers who weren't beginning teachers. Because the way it worked is school districts had to fund 47.5, they have to reach the 47.5 for beginning teachers. In many of your classrooms in your districts, you have an 11-year teacher making the same as a first-year teacher. Every salary, because of local control, because of collective bargaining, every salary schedule is different. But what this bill does is it's not just saying, go ahead, school boards, do what you need to do your salaries. There are percentages that are mandated in this bill. And if the idea was do what you need to do to pay your teachers, you would remove that language to give us that flexibility. You would say work to make sure every beginning teacher has 47.5, and then all the rest of the allocation can be divided. But it doesn't do that. The language is very specific as to how the percentages need to be used. And this will be a real problem for all of us when we return to our district. All of us know teachers who are mentoring beginning teachers who are making the same as them or more. So we need to work on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Recognizing Representative Valdez.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And
try to make it real quick because we're running out of time here.
It'll be very short.
Thank you.
I echo the sentiments of Representative Fetterhoff coming from Hillsborough County, although the schools are not in my voting district, but they are in my county. We have a large percentage of the schools that are in this category, the turnaround. So I'm really, really concerned about the equity aspect. So I will be in support of this today in hopes that we can continue the conversation and really coming forward to something where we can really talk about equity and not lose sight of those children. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Representative Valdez. We're now out of debate, and I'll turn it back over or ask Chair Fine, and you're recognized to close on your bill.
Madam Chair, don't we have 20 minutes left?
Till one. Yes. Are you good? Okay. Do we have any? I didn't know we had any more debate. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Will Halley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one topic to talk about. And I guess I get nervous when I say we're repealing a program, and that's why I ask, because we had a lot of conversation about it. And Representative Lupus, I love the work you've done. I know that you that's your heart's passion, your life's work. I guess I just get nervous as when we put programs in place and we say they don't work, but myself, I gave the example, and it took my wife and I almost 10 months to get the funding from the state. When we put a program in place that I think an educated person is not able to navigate, I don't know what the everyday person that doesn't have Wi-Fi, a computer, a single family that's working hard, that has multiple kids, and all these different things, they can actually function and get this. So I guess I just get nervous when we put it. So if we're repealing it and we're replacing it with something better and something that is not going to be a government speed bump to people that really need it, I absolutely want to support that. I get nervous when that happens because I'm an example. And again, I mentioned committee how I did this on purpose. First of all, my son needed the tutoring, all right? And we recognized he almost got retained in third grade and stuff. And so when we tried to do it, and it took that long and the process was so difficult, of course it was a failure system. It was a failure of government because we put so many speed bumps in there on people. And so if we're repealing it and we're going to make it better, I applaud you. And Chair Fine, I like that if we recognize all these programs were in place and didn't work and we're going to fix it now. But let's make sure it works because, like I say, it has failed. And the reason that a small percentage took advantage of it is because only a small percentage can navigate the process. And so let's fix this and let's make it better because the absolute need is for that student to get what they need and to get that additional reading, training, and tutoring that they need to make sure that they thrive and do better. So thank you, and thank you for the time, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Will Height. Any other debate? We'll close debate, and now I will recognize Chair Fine. You're recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, and let me address a number of comments that people have made, because look, it's a complicated bill. It came out a couple days ago, and I have been fairly busy, and I apologize I didn't reach out to each one of you in advance of the bill, something I almost always do, but because I was focused on the school choice bill yesterday, I didn't have the time to do that. So a number of the comments that were made aren't necessarily correct. So I want to kind of walk through for some of them. First off, I want everyone to know, when we get the number one feedback we get from school superintendents on our budget every year is we hate categoricals. Please get rid of them. Give us the money. Give us the flexibility. So we are trying to do that here. It's only three. It could be a lot more, but we're going in the direction, the feedback we're getting from the local areas. To address Representative Federhoff's concerns, I think you conflated a number of issues. So let me walk through them. The 300 schools and the requirement that they do the extra hour of instruction, that doesn't change under this bill. We've made that requirement in two separate places. It will still remain in the reading instruction categorical. We're not eliminating the requirement. We're just not going to have the same requirement in two separate places. That's all we're doing there. The other thing is we're conflating the 300 schools with the turnaround wraparound services schools. Those are not necessarily the same audiences. So your 300 schools, you still have to do that if you have seven of them. They're not necessarily the turnaround schools or the wraparound schools. Those are different universes. The third thing is we're conflating, I think, to some degree, the reading scholarship, which we are eliminating, with the turnaround program. The turnaround program, that money is going away, and it is going into the base. But I would point out part of the reason that we are doing this is we have the supplemental academic instruction categorical that is supposed to do basically the same thing. And for those of you who are considering voting no, here's what you will be voting against. We are proposing to put the turnaround services in the base budget. That is $26 million. We are proposing to increase the supplemental academic instruction categorical by $265 million, 10 times the amount. So the amount of money that will be available to help these schools is going up hugely under the budget as described in this bill. I think Representative Will Height sort of made the best argument that I could have, that the reading program doesn't work. And they've had a lot of opportunity to fix it. This isn't a program that we put out for 1 year and it didn't work, and now we're going to get rid of it. There have been many warning signs to the owners of that program that they needed to do something. We started by funding it with $10 million. People didn't take advantage. So we said, you know what, let's kind of fire a warning shot across the bow and say, hey, you know, we probably need to make this thing work better. And we cut the $10 million to $7.6 million, and the message wasn't delivered. So to me, it's sort of a three strikes and you're out kind of thing. It's not a one-year, it didn't work, we're giving up on it. And again, there's no disagreement on the importance of literacy. This program's not working. But if we spend the $7.6 million, again, on a program no one's taking advantage of, we may not have the funding to send the books to kids who are not being able to read at the level we want, or to do Representative Alupis's program. We only have so much money to work with. No disagreement on literacy. There's a view that not all programs work, even if the motives are good. And I think you have described that. The last thing I would say, I disagree with Representative Bartleman that the $500 million teacher pay increase was a mistake. You know, no one's pay was cut. No one's. Is the compression greater? Yes, but the choice was, but everyone who benefited from that program benefited. No one was hurt by the program. And the reason that we are putting it in this way is we do not want this problem to happen again, where new teachers are way, way at the bottom and other teachers are way at the top. This is the language that is in there is intended to make sure that this 47.5 grows. And it is 150% until they reach the 47.5, because some school districts haven't gotten there yet. It just encourages them to get there. But it is not 150% after they're at 47.5. Experienced teacher salaries can grow faster than new teachers once they're at that 47.5 under the language that we are in here. So look, it's a lot. I mean, the budget was a lot. You all have asked great questions. My door will remain open. We're going to be on the floor, I think, for 47 hours over the next over the next 2 days. So feel free to come over. Fortunately, this week I don't have to present any bills, so I will have time if you want to talk about any of this stuff. But you know, we're trying to make some real changes in a crazy world where all of this money is coming from the feds and we have all of these problems that we want to solve. I think this is the culmination of some great work that we have done as a committee. It will continue to evolve. It will continue to improve. But I think this continues to move forward a floor. Move forward a floor. I can't say it. I'm going to stop saying that. Make Florida better. That's all I'm going to say. And I don't get tongue twisted very often. So with that, I'd ask for your favorable support.
Thank you, Chair Fine. Now we'll move on. Rosa, will you please call the roll on PCB PKA 21-01?
Chair Fine?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bell?
Yes.
Representatives Alupis?
Yes.
Andrade?
Yes.
Bartleman?
No.
Bush?
Yes.
Fetterhoff?
Yes.
Fetterhoff?
Yes.
Haig?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Roach?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Prunow?
Yes.
Valdez?
Yes.
Wilhite?
Yes.
Williams?
Yes.
14 yeas, 1 nay.
Thank you. By your vote, PCB PKA 21-01 will be reported favorably. Congratulations, Chair Fine, and I will now pass the gavel back to you.
Well, thank you, members. That concludes all the business that we had for today. We are going to continue to meet, even though our budget will be done and submitted. Now, whatever meetings we have left will be available to hear policy bills as those bills come out of Representative Alupis's committee and Representative McLean's committee and others. We will have time available to begin to consider those should we put them on an agenda. So our next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, March 30th from 4 to 7 o'clock. So I'll see you all then. With that, members, this concludes our committee agenda. Seeing no further business, Vice Chair Bell, who did a great job today, moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.
I want to ask you before we leave, because we'll